Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. Before we get into our program today, I'd like, as I do always, turn to you, our listeners, and make a request asking if you would consider giving us some information about your reaction to our programs, about some ideas perhaps, or for some topics. We'd love to be able to present to you what you are looking for. So please feel free to contact us. And as always, I'll give you two ways of reaching us. One, the good old traditional stamp on a letter. Send a letter to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. And the zip code in Greenwich, 06836. That's 06836. If you're on the computer and rather email us, please do so at clemons10@aol.com. Let me spell that for you. C-L-E-M-O-N-S, the number 10@aol.com. While you're on the computer, I invite you to go to our magazine, Spirituality for Today, and you can find Spirituality for Today at this site, spirituality.org. That's spirituality.org. Don't go to com, because I'll bring you somewhere else. So we hope that you take advantage of that magazine for you. Besides the features and articles, we also have this radio program that you can listen to at your leisure. So we certainly would love to have you do that. Now, we are delighted to be able to welcome as our guest today on Thoughts for the Week, Dr. Gary Rose. Dr. Rose is the professor and department chair for Government, Politics, and Global Studies at Sacred Heart University here in Fairfield, Connecticut, where we produce this program. And you probably have four more titles and more involvement, so we'll get off to that. But welcome, Dr. Rose. Welcome.
Great to be here.
It's a delight to have you here, too. Now, as we, politics. What a great topic for you to be involved in these days. I would like in our this particular program to take a look, sort of in general, at the world of government and politics and affairs of state. And our listeners, there will be another program where we will look specifically at the 2016 election. So I hope that our listeners be on the lookout there too. Well, first off, what kind of drew you as a young person toward the study of government?
Well, I came from a pretty politically active family. My mother was a district coordinator for the Democratic Party in the town of Cheshire, Connecticut. And the Democrats at the time were actually the minority party, but nevertheless, she was very active in that. And my father, too, had very strong political beliefs, although he wasn't active in politics. So we talked an awful lot about politics around the dinner table, quite frankly, and my brothers, too. My older brothers had political views. And then when I was a young boy, and I will still say that this was perhaps a turning point, I went to a political rally in the city of New Haven. I went down in a multi-town motorcade to see John F. Kennedy speak, it was during the 1960 presidential campaign, and I will say that was really, in many ways, almost a turning point in my life, because I was very inspired by his words, even though I was a young kid. I came home, and I remember I nailed a sign to my oak tree, the big oak tree in the yard, Kennedy for President, and I still have that sign, by the way.
I do, yeah.
And that was very important. And then, you know, as I moved through life, I would say also being in the Army, being in the military, and serving in Germany during the Cold War, I certainly saw, I think, the effects of politics on the lives of people. I was actually stationed along a border unit where I could see East Germany all the time, and I could see the effects of, obviously, the Soviet Union in East Germany from my vantage point in the West. And it was around that time when I decided, you know, I think I have a lot to say. Not that my opinion is what matters. It's just I have a lot to teach and a lot to share. And so kind of an accumulation of events, probably beginning, you know, around the dinner table and extending all the way into my early 20s. And it was when I got out of the Army, I decided this is what I want to do for a living. I want to be a university professor.
That's something great. I'm glad that you fulfilled that, certainly. As we take a look at the area of politics, especially, it's interesting that you mentioned your mother's active involvement. How does one get into politics? How does one end up perhaps choosing to become a candidate for office?
Yeah, well, here in Connecticut, you have to, for most offices, unless you are extremely wealthy and a self-funder, and we do have some of them around, but normally you have to begin with actually the local town committee. If you want to run for office, say, for the state legislature here in Connecticut or a town council position, city council, what have you, you have to work with your town committee to get, you know, the nod. And so they really, to this day, still remain the gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after you get that, you have to go to a convention or a caucus, and you have to win the party's nomination. But it's very difficult to do that, you know, for, let's say, a small race if you don't have your town committee. And if you want to run for governor in the state, you still have to, right now, this is what they're doing. They're going all around the state of Connecticut trying to secure the support of town committees so that they can get delegates to go to the state nominating conventions. And then after that, if you do qualify for a primary at the convention by winning 15% or more, then you can force a primary, and that's when you go to the voters. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question directly, it really begins in many ways, regardless of what office you're running for. Again, the exception being the extremely wealthy self-funders. Mm-hmm. You have to normally work through the structure of party politics in the state of Connecticut. You do. And they to this day, serve as really the filters and the gatekeepers for many, many candidacies.
So unless you have sufficient capital to initiate your own campaign, politics is really local.
It really is. You know, it was Tip O'Neill who said, of course, all politics is local. Mm-hmm. And yeah, in many ways it is. That's where it begins, at the grassroots for so many people. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Would you say that that both national and local politics are really the same entity, or is it what is the difference? Is it a distinction?
No, I think that really when you get into national politics, the hot button issues, you know, are more profound there, particularly those issues that are so dividing our country today, such as the social and moral issues. Now, up at, you know, in Hartford here, the Connecticut state capital, it's really largely financial and budgetary issues that divide Republicans from Democrats. But at the national level, it's not only, you know, fiscal matters that divide the two parties, but there you get into a whole range of issues that have certainly brought to the fore, you know, interest groups and spokespersons for interest groups that really pull, you know, at the candidates and pull at our members of Congress and the president too. So I would say that the big difference really is that the polarization between the parties is substantially different, and particularly the issues that are dividing the two parties. I mean, we're going to have tomorrow night, we're going to have a State of the Union address. Mm-hmm. And one of the big divisive issues there, of course, is immigration. Mm-hmm. Now, immigration is not really dividing Republicans and Democrats up in Hartford at the state capitol, but in D.C., it's a huge issue, of course, as well as foreign policy issues are getting very divisive. At one time, you know, they always said politics stops at the water's edge. That has ceased to be the fact. Mm-hmm. Now, every single issue, whether it's domestic or foreign, they've all become hot-button issues at the national level. Mm-hmm. And I would contend that that separates national politics from the state and local politics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we see our two state senators, certainly have been on the media and dominant in the media in many ways.
Very much so.
Is there something particular that surprised you at all, or was that something that expected?
No. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, Senator Blumenthal, for example, when he was the Attorney General in Connecticut, he was on TV all the time. Mm-hmm. So the fact that he's still in the media a lot is not at all surprising. I think a little bit of a surprise here, and I did do a book on the Senate race between Murphy and McMahon, and And I would say I'm a little surprised at the high profile that Senator Murphy is now assuming, particularly on the issue of gun rights, although I understand he was originally the congressman from the 5th Congressional District. But nevertheless, I'm not surprised that Blumenthal is getting the national press that, that he's been getting, and with the Russian probe and so forth. I am a little surprised at the high profile and the
Murphy
and the press that he's getting, and it's starting to make me wonder wonder if in fact Senator Murphy has his sights set maybe even a little higher than the U.S. Senate.
Well, obviously locally you want to get yourself known at a state level, and I presume that jumping in on the media, the major media markets, are the way to get yourself known.
Sure.
And the national level.
Very much
Yeah, that's
so.
Interesting. Even Jim Himes, he even appears. I guess it's because he's on the Intelligence Committee.
Yes, he is. Yeah. Himes is actually a rising star within that party, and I think we're probably going to see, you know, even more efforts on his part in the days ahead to raise that profile. I think so.
Boy, Connecticut has a interesting position.
I know, we do.
Wow. Now, now the role of the lobbyists... Over the years, have certainly had its defenders and its critics. Does the lobbyist at the local level in the state of Connecticut, is that a real important factor?
Oh, the lobbyists are huge up in Hartford, sure. They're not hard to identify because Connecticut requires them to wear a badge that says lobbyist.
There you go.
It's not hard to identify who they are. But when you go up there during budget negotiations and look up in the you know, the galleries there, they're all over the place. And out in the hallways waiting, lobbyists are huge in Connecticut, sure, just as they are in so many other states and certainly in D.C. And what we're finding is not just, you know, the typical traditional types of lobbying, you know, what we call client-based lobbying. That is where, you know, an organization or a corporation, a company, a union, whatever, hires a lobbyist. But now we have even contract lobbyists. That is, we have lobbyists who basically, for all intents and purposes, are mercenaries, you know, and they work for any issue. And they will work both sides of the aisle if needed, and or even bring both sides of the aisle together on issues. It's a new form of lobbying. When I say new, it's not, I mean, maybe 25 years old or so, but yeah, there's been a tremendous proliferation of lobbyists. Virtually every issue in the state of Connecticut, economic, social, moral, in many ways. Again, not the intensity that you see in D.C., but nevertheless, there are lobbyists up at the state capitol. So much of it has to do with budgetary and fiscal matters and spending issues. Yeah.
When you think about the role of lobbyists, are they obviously they're working for a company to promote a particular stand or support a particular policy? Do they provide good, accurate, substantial information, or are they providing only the type of information that's going to get the results they're hired to achieve?
You know, that's a great question that you asked, because there have been studies done of lobbyists and also congresspersons and lawmakers. And what we learn is that the most valuable asset, you know, that lobbyists provide to members of Congress and state lawmakers is reliable information. Now, obviously, it is presented in a way to persuade, but it's well understood that if lobbyists are up there misleading, you know, lawmakers, presenting them with information that is not factual and totally stilted and totally, you know, distorted in a way to benefit their interest, normally the lawmaker can see through that. So, you know, lobbyists, it's got a very bad connotation. You hear the term lobbyists, and, you know, you think of some backroom deal and a guy with a cigar cutting deals with somebody. But they do provide a lot of useful information to lawmakers to help them decide on how to vote on issues. And so, actually, I'm a proponent of lobbyists, and it's protected under the First Amendment. And it is true they're there to persuade and to win their case, but at the same time, they do provide information that help lawmakers, both federal and state, to arrive at, I think, better decisions. I do.
Well, again, being the lawmakers are being inundated with all sorts of laws.
That's right.
But they need to, as you're saying, accurate information.
I think so. You need information, you know, to make to pass legislation, and lobbyists, I think, provide that. Now, you know, you do get into some issues with the campaign contributions from lobbyists and so forth. I can understand why there's a lot of trepidation and concern over that. But at the same time, on policy matters, difficult policy matters, that's not to say a lawmaker has to follow what a lobbyist says by any means, but to get another body of information, to have them look at a policy issue from a particular point of view, I think it's, you know, and maybe they can discount it in the end, but in the end, I think that that's a very valuable resource for a lawmaker.
Hmm. You sort of introduced the idea of campaign financing, and it's always another of those issues that are so difficult to deal with. I think as a person sitting in the living room watching all of this, you say, well, unless you're a billionaire, you can't even run for office. Yeah. And where the money comes from and the influence that it has, are we dealing with, I'm just wondering, what type of reform can you envision?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see an awful lot of reform in that area. I mean, we do have the Citizens Election Program in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. That was considered a real step forward, where we do provide public financing for, you know, people running for state office as well as state legislative offices. At the federal level, you know, we do provide for public funding for presidential candidates, but lately, because of the exorbitant costs, they've not tapped into that fund, and they've all basically have fundraised on their own, far above what the ceiling is on public financing. The reform, I will say, quite honestly, has been in the direction of actually opening the floodgates more for more money, not less.
Right.
And you could call that reform if you'd like, but nevertheless, the Supreme Court has taken the position that because money supposedly is speech under the First Amendment, that it should be deregulated, you know, and not heavily constrained. And so the Citizens Election the Citizens United program that was decided a while back, you know, basically allowed corporations to open their treasuries and just start shoveling money into campaigns. Now, those are reforms, but they're not certainly moving in a way that I think necessarily benefits the small guy who wants to get into politics.
Yeah. When we think of the people from our particular state or any state that go to Congress, I wonder if you could tell or speak a little bit about the role of being a representative from the state to try to benefit the state. The voters are going to say, and what have you done for us, or how are you serving us, versus having to serve the country, the well-being of the country.
Yeah, that's another interesting question, you know, because a representative in the U.S. Congress or the U.S. Senate really does have, you know, centrifugal and centripetal pulls, if you will. And they have to obviously, you know, think about national issues, but at the same time, what comes first for them, I will say, is really the concerns of their constituents, because that's what gets them reelected. And so at times, you know, some of their positions on issues might seem at cross purposes with the national interest. But nevertheless, you do have to balance the two. It's a very difficult balancing act, and members of Congress certainly have commented on that as well, that you got the pull of party and national interest, while at the same time you have these local concerns. But in the end, we do know that it's really the concerns of the state and the districts and the localities that actually often govern the voting behavior of a member of Congress. But today, a lot of those, the interesting thing, though, is that a lot of those concerns are in line with some national concerns as well. So it's not necessarily like you have, you know, two separate issues at times pulling at people.
Would the local concerns of a person serving in Congress versus national issues that they're dealing with, is that where the compromises come in? Like, gee, we want to get something good for our industry in Connecticut. Maybe this other way, I need this vote from this person.
Well, we got this long tradition there known as log rolling, you know. And, yeah, it's true. I mean, if you want to get something for your own state, sometimes you might have to help somebody from another state, too, you know, get their objective into law. And so there are issues. And so and maybe you have to at times give a little bit, you know, compromise in order to achieve that. But at the same time, you know, the compromising, though, it's interesting you mentioned that, today seems more likely to occur within parties as opposed to between parties. And there, again, because the districts today and the states have become so separated that the compromising often seems to be within party as opposed to across the aisle. And that's a problem here. Yeah, that's a real problem for our country, the polarization.
Also, as you, I think, inferred there, that within each party, which certainly when I was growing up, and I think we are contemporaries, that we had a sense of, well, Democrats are working toward the working people, the Republicans are trying to help business grow. But now we have all of these kind of polarizing effects of within the party. So we have parties within parties, I guess. You know, someone commented that they perhaps think that the parties are beginning to lose their identities to the point that maybe the party system itself might be affected.
Oh, I don't know if I would go that far. The party today, you know, there was a time where it seemed like the parties were getting weaker and that it was more candidate-based politics. But then over the years, largely because of realignments that have occurred, regional realignments, you know, in the South and in the North, and now the way ethnic groups have gravitated into one party or another. Actually, I mean, you do have obviously factions within parties, and as I said, you do have to work sometimes within the party to forge compromises, but you'd be surprised how ideologically compatible most Democrats are today, regardless of what part of the country they live in, and how ideologically compatible most Republicans are, too. And that's one reason why we have this often this stalemate that takes place.
When we think of other countries, I realize that you're also involved with global studies. How do they, let's say the democracies, of course, would have an understanding, and those who are not countries, not democracies, would have their own approach. We've heard that America was looked at for great leadership within the world. How do, let's say, other democracies, or what do they expect from America versus those other sort of totalitarian governments?
Sure. Well, you know, really going back to the days of President Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, the president was perceived as the leader of the free world. And even though President Trump is talking about America first, which is somewhat of a departure from, that's not to say other presidents didn't put America first, but I mean his rhetoric certainly is much stronger on that side, and some of his policies certainly are that way too. But it does, I would still argue that despite what seems to be much more of a nationalistic approach on the president's part, that the leaders of foreign countries still look to the U.S., you know, for not just military protection, a lot of them, but also I think for economic leadership and in many ways how to set their own agendas, and so their policy agendas, you know, how it factors into U.S. foreign policy. So to answer your question, I would say that it's true that a lot of foreign policy leaders are probably taken aback by President Trump and his mannerisms and his language at times and so forth, but still they still see the president, I believe, as being really the pivotal, you know, force in the world. And I think despite some of them, like Macron and others, saying, you know, and Angela Merkel, you know, questioning aspects of the president's conduct, they still see the president, I think, as somebody they know they have to work with and not necessarily follow but accommodate to a large extent. Sure.
When I think of the voter, and I want to get to that before the program runs out of time, as a voter and our responsibilities as a voter, what should we do to get a greater understanding of the reality of particular candidates? Washington, you know, we really are almost brainwashed with the notion that Washington is just a, I think, what was it? I think when U.S. Grant, Ulysses S. Grant was considering running for president, that William Tecumseh Sherman told him, "Don't do it. They're all a bunch of thieves down there. Yeah. Stay away from it." I said, "Boy, this sounds familiar." Yeah. I mean, is it somewhat accurate to say that there is a level of corruption, or there's a corruptive influence once you get into that world in the Beltway, within the Beltway? And it makes it difficult for the politician to really polish up the image of even though we want to feel that way. Mm-hmm. Yet, what was it now? I think There was an American theologian in the early 19th century, James Freeman Clark, who said, a politician thinks of the next election, a statesman of the next generation. Yeah. Is it possible to blend that in some way?
You know, it's very hard not to play the game when you're in Washington. Mm-hmm. And just as an example of that, Jimmy Carter was elected on a campaign to restore trust in politics and government. And he did not want to, so-called drink with the boys when he got down there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in many ways a standoffish president because he didn't want to get pulled into that, the politics of the Beltway, if you will. And what happened to Jimmy Carter? You know, one-term president, And not an awful lot was accomplished as a result of that. So corruption, I wouldn't say that that's inevitable, but I will say that what is inevitable is playing the game to get things done, and you've got to learn how to do that if you expect to really be a lawmaker. I'm not saying everybody has to be like Lyndon Baines Johnson, where you have to, you know, cut deals on every single issue and give and take the way that he did. But you got to learn to negotiate. You got to learn to give a little bit. You know, if you want to get, some of your policies passed, you can't expect to get 100%. You know, you got to be willing to get a certain percentage of it. But I wouldn't go so far as to say you necessarily have to submit yourself to corruption, but you do have to submit yourself to politics if you want to govern.
Would you feel that someone like President Obama also, in his time, kind of tried to stay away from...
He tried, yes, and for the most part he did. And he did. He was fortunate to have a Congress, at least in the beginning there, that was willing to work with him in the beginning. But he would be another one, even though he had two terms, and he was able to get health care passed, but again, he did so strictly a partisan vote. But Obama, I think, would be an example of somebody also who really did not appreciate the ways of D.C. and tried to keep himself as separate from that as possible. It's hard to tell, you know, other than health care and maybe some other issues, what his major achievements were, however. And I'm not so sure how he's going to be rated in the days ahead.
Would you say that he was caught up also in a... Really, the divisiveness between the parties, where
very much so.
Republicans didn't want to compromise.
Oh, very much so. In fact, it was Mitch McConnell upon Obama's election who said that his goal will be to make sure that President Obama fails. And so that was the environment that he worked within.
It's tough to do anything good for anybody at that point.
I know.
The perhaps final question of the day, if somebody wants to learn more about politics or learn more about how it all works in a global world today, so they can be more informed, well, what would you suggest?
Read.
Do you trust it? I just worry about bias.
I was just going to say, be careful what you read. And I would say read a different body of newspapers. I strongly recommend to my students, if time permits, to read the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and maybe, you know, Washington Post. All of this is online now, so you don't have to subscribe, to three hard copies. And then I would recommend, if time permits, you can learn about politics by looking at diverse news shows. And I would say just don't lock yourself into Fox or MSNBC, but take it all in. PBS is also good,
Good.
But just read and watch different news shows and read as much as you can.
I
think you can come to your own conclusions that way.
Well, we've been speaking to Dr. Gary Rose, who is professor and department chair for government, politics, and global studies here at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. We thank you for being with us. Please, our listeners, join us again.